sanity for a change. The Rick Smith Show.
Heaven knocking on the door that holds the throne. I've been looking for the map that leads me home. I've been stumbling on good hearts turned to stone. The road of good intentions is going dry as a bone. We take care of our own.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, ricksmithshow.com. So as we're seeing reports across the Caribbean islands of violence erupting, because guess what? There's no food. There's no water. Everything has been washed away. And what you've got left are desperate people who are in desperate need of assistance. And the sad reality is you know, these, in my view, it's not just going to be poverty-stricken areas in the future who are going to be in this kind of a situation. Right here in the U.S., I fear that this is our reality as these storms get bigger, more frequent, and, well, worse. Anyway, here to talk to us a little bit about what Harvey dumped on Texas. Our good friend Propane Jane is back. Jane, thanks for taking time for us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me back.
So first question, how are you guys doing? How are you doing after the storm?
Well, we're doing well. Just speaking for my household individually, miraculously, our house is high and dry, and we were really blessed and fortunate to be faring pretty well so far. And, you know, the city of Houston is resilient. We're strong, and things are eventually, slowly but surely, getting back to normal.
How bad was it during the height?
It was pretty bad. I mean, you know, as background, I'm a native Houstonian. I've lived here all my life. I'll be 36 in October. So I've seen my fair share of storms come through the city. Where I live is about 30 miles southwest of Houston proper. And, you know, we tend to fare pretty well in storms. We don't live in, you know, what's considered to be a traditional, floodplain. And so even though the storms have come and gone, you know, we've gotten out mostly with, you know, some flash flooding and maybe some high water areas, but nowhere near the level of devastation that is just all over the city. I mean, in places that have never flooded before, they're completely underwater. So in terms of just change and the dynamics of what this storm brought to the city compared to what we've seen in the past, I mean, there's no comparison. And, you know, I'm just in awe. I mean, you know, it's very surreal. You know, for example, on my street, we didn't get any water in our house, but we're one of only two families that didn't get water in our house. The rest of the street has had to pull up their whole, you know, all of their floors on the first level of their house.
Wow.
And when, you know, as you drive out of my neighborhood, still today, September 11th, I can't even keep track of time. I can't even tell you how long it's been since it hit, but there's still belongings piled up on the sidewalk, you know, as we drive out of our neighborhood. So
that was the one thing we had gone down after Hurricane Katrina, you know, like several months later, and mm-hmm. there were still piles of people's stuff and still piles of debris that hadn't been, and this is, we're talking, you know, like 10 months later, that hadn't been taken away because there was just so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And what's so bizarre about it is that, you know, you can be, you know, 10 minutes away. I mean, for instance, we were on mandatory evacuation from our house, because we live pretty close to a major levee for this area, and we also live pretty close to a creek system that flows out into the Brazos River, which, you know, was overflowing. And so the streets basically just couldn't contend with all the water. So we were on mandatory evacuation for 6 days, and we were at my parents' house, and they live just 11 minutes away. And their streets were completely dry. And so just, you know, you can be in certain areas of town and it looks totally normal. It looks like nothing happened. And you just drive a few blocks over, and it's a complete disaster area.
Yeah, again, going back to Hurricane Katrina while we were there, it's the same dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
The poor areas that were, you know, at lower elevations, they were devastated. The wealthier areas appeared fairly unscathed.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that's what's so interesting about these storms in particular, and I think for the Houston area, you know, if you don't live in Houston, if you've never been to Houston, or even just the state of Texas, actually, it's hard to really appreciate how widespread our communities are, and how far from, you know, the major metropolitan area our development is. And so in this storm in particular, I think it really highlights how, you know, it isn't really class-based. I mean, there are neighborhoods here in Houston that are million-dollar homes that are flooded out. And so everyone was affected. Certainly, you know, their ability to recover is going to be different based on what their means are. But in terms of who bore the brunt of the catastrophe, it really is all of us. Harvey didn't discriminate. And, you know, I think that's one of the things that's unfortunate about how we cover these disasters and these storms. You know, if you take Trump, for example, you know, among other, you know, insults that occurred when he came to Houston, you know, he visited the shelters and he made it a very significant point to, you know, make sure that he picked up children of color. And as a Houstonian, as someone who lives in, you know, a very affluent suburb, who's seeing people of all walks of life who are affected by this storm, in particular white people that voted for Trump,
right,
that live out in the suburbs, who were affected by this, who while he's there at the shelter, are trying to dig, you know, mud out of their homes. They're trying to get sewage out of their homes. And so, you know, I think that that's going to be interesting as well in Florida. You know, all of these affluent people who live on the, you know, on the coast, who have all of these properties, these boats, they're going to be affected in the same way.
Yeah, but here's the difference, and you alluded to this a moment ago. The difference is I don't think there are very many affluent people living in those shelters at that moment. I think most
right,
of those folks
absolutely.
Had the resources to get out. And these storms,
yeah.
You know, while as you've pointed out, didn't discriminate based on class, your ability to prepare and recover really,
mm-hmm.
really is about class.
It absolutely is. And I think, again, you know, what's again so interesting about this flood is that, you know, something like 90% of the people affected don't have flood insurance. And so, again, these are areas that traditionally do not flood. And even in places that do flood, a lot of people still don't make that investment to have flood insurance. And so, you know, this is something that costs thousands upon thousands of dollars, you know, to rip out basically the guts of your home and start over again. And so this is why, you know, there, you know, at last count that I saw, you know, last week, I've lost track of it now, it was about 500,000 people had registered for FEMA assistance, for Harvey in particular. And so there are people who are applying for federal assistance who maybe have never, you know, requested government assistance for anything in their entire life.
Right.
But when you start looking at, you know, 10, $15,000, $20,000, $40,000, $50,000, you know, a lot of people, that's gonna break them. They may be able to sort of get by and live a middle-class life, but when you add such an expense, kind of like a healthcare expense, you know, something like that, it can really change their financial circumstances.
Yeah, and then there are going to be those who, well, we won't replace the floor, and you'll have mold underneath it, and then
right.
you end up with sick kids and sick family members, and there's nothing good in this scenario, really not.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean, you know, again, what I just keep going back to, you know, and have been, you know, even in the midst of this storm, is what is our government response going to be? You know, how do we navigate this situation when we have people in government who don't necessarily think government is supposed to do anything useful for the people?
Exactly. So let me ask you that, though, because it was one of the questions I wanted to get to is, you know, the president did go down there, and I said from the beginning, I don't think he should have gone. He should have stayed away Send the resources, send the messaging. Get, if he wanted to show up, get some work boots on and do a much better job loading the truck than just putting five boxes in the back of a truck.
Right.
But I'm curious, you being there, what was the sense of his coming? Did you want him there? Was that a good thing? What do you think?
I tweeted that same day, I'm still on mandatory evacuation from my home. Ask me how much I care. I didn't use that word. I actually used an expletive. Ask me how much I care that he's here in the city of Houston. Because at that point, I was still trying to figure out, is my house underwater? Am I going to be able to get my kids back into the neighborhood safely? When is school going to start? You know, all of these things that when you're still in the midst of the crisis. And I think that's kind of what is getting lost in this, is that, yes, the eye of the storm may not be on top of us anymore, but we're still in a crisis. And so coming into this environment in the midst of that, either you need to be doing it to say, okay, I'm here to, see the devastation. I'm here to see, how we can make the appropriate federal response to this, or I'm here to demonstrate volunteerism. I'm here to go into someone's house and actually show to the American people what people are contending with. I'm going to actually sit down and talk to somebody who's living in this shelter and try to understand how we're going to get housing for 40,000 people who are displaced now. And so it's that side of it in terms of him just not even really connecting the visit to a legislative agenda. But also the fact that he was insulting. I mean, he made very flippant remarks. He signed the wall in the NRG shelter. He was still a sociopath in the midst of a crisis.
Yeah, it was all about him, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And so I think that is very much how, it was seen by at least the people that I communicated with here, on the ground, who just sort of feel like, rolling their eyes, like, I have too much going on to pay attention to whatever he's doing right now to get attention. And whatever he's doing is a distraction from what I'm actually trying to do to dig myself out of this.
Right.
But I think also just, from just kind of a cost standpoint, I think I'm personally insulted by it, because these are the same people who are telling us that we're not going to have the money to fund disaster relief, but yet they're going to spend millions of dollars shuffling Donald Trump around to these disaster areas just to kind of take pictures and make a show of being there, but not actually do anything to help the people that are there. So I think that's a very dangerous precedent that he's setting in terms of wasting money that he's then going to turn around and take away from the agencies that need it.
Yeah, I mean, one of the first things he did, talking about the crowds. It was great to see so many people out there. Really? did you go to crowds? Did you go there?
It's not. I mean, it's not really a good thing that we have 40,000 people displaced from their homes and in shelters. I mean, yes, it's great that we have the ability to house them, but ultimately that is not a sustainable situation. One of the most profound sort of things that has affected me in my life is that I was in medical school on clinical rotations when Hurricane Katrina hit. And so much of what was going on at that time in terms of just me learning, the ropes of being a physician was meeting with people who were displaced from New Orleans and how they didn't have their medications and how difficult it was for them to live in a shelter. And even now, I mean, a lot of my patients that I have who moved here from Katrina still talk about what the emotional toll of those initial, months when they didn't have housing and they were living in a shelter, what that was like for them. And there's a lot of PTSD and anxiety that is still associated with that. So I think for him to be focusing on, hey, there's all these people here, it's his rally or something, And not really understanding the significance of what that means for so many people to be housed in that situation and how important it is to get them out of there as soon as possible, you know, he's just missing it. He's missing the forest for the trees.
It kind of reminded me when Barbara Bush went to Houston, when the Katrina people from Katrina were leaving Louisiana. And she said, "Well, they look very comfortable. They're just happy to be here." And it was really one of those very tone deaf moments where you're going, "Really, really, Barbara?"
Yeah. And you know, and I think what's so interesting is how things have changed, right? I mean, you know, in terms of the ex-presidents and the effort that George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush are putting together, you know, with Bill Clinton and President Obama. Just in terms of, like, understanding what is actually going on when it hits your own backyard. You know, I mean, I think for a lot of these people, you know, in particular the Bushes, when you juxtapose, you know, what happened with Katrina and their response now that it's in Texas, and certainly we want to be thankful and grateful that people are helping. But I think, you know, one thing that is so important and that we're seeing in the politics of this is that, you know, people like Ted Cruz or somebody like Marco Rubio, you know, they feel a certain way about something when it's happening to other people and it's not their state. And then all of a sudden they take this new position, you know, when it's affecting their constituents.
So what you're saying is, you know, the people who voted against the Sandy money or tried to break up the Sandy money, now saying, hey, bring it to our state. So the other question is that, do you have any respect for the 90 who voted against the money for Houston, you know, based on, hey, you know, screw those people?
Yeah, I have no respect for them, including the four Texans who voted against the relief. And I think that this is going to be sincerely a come to Jesus moment for these people, because, you know, there are the congressional Republicans that still want to do this, you know, small government, you know, they don't want to spend any federal dollars on this, and they gladly are saying, hey, you know, do states' rights and y'all take care of your own situation. Which you know, maybe would make some sense if all of these states weren't red states that are mismanaged, that don't have the money they're supposed to have, and that are also going to be stingy. You know, again, if you look at Texas and Greg Abbott, we allegedly, and I say allegedly very strongly, have a $10 billion rainy day fund. We've now had the rainiest day ever. We got 50 inches of rain, rainiest days ever. And they're not talking about tapping that fund. We don't even know if the money's there. And so I do think that, you know, the state Republican Party wants the federal government to chip in now all of a sudden. And they're up against a federal government that wants the state to take a crack at it.
Isn't it amazing how that ideology kind of plays itself against one another?
Yeah.
And I would argue that they win regardless. It's one of those heads I win, tails you lose kind of scenarios, because they just pit one against the other, and gridlock is victory for them because they can say, look, government doesn't work.
Yeah. And again, I think that this is a very interesting moment again, because they have all three branches of government, and they have crises that are affecting Republican-controlled, quote-unquote, state. And unfortunately, you know, it's not going to just be a, you know, let them handle their mess, because what's happening in these states in particular is going to affect the rest of the country. You know, when you talk about oil and gas and you talk about these refineries that are in the Gulf and how much they supply to the rest of the country, look at Florida, their crops. You know, billions of dollars of crops that the rest of the country, you know, how's the rest of the country going to feel if suddenly oranges or orange juice is $15?
Yeah, well, gas shot up in our neighborhood, what, 45 cents a gallon?
Yeah.
50 cents a gallon?
So again, you know, I think that they would, that the Republican Party would love to just sort of throw their hands up and go, government doesn't work, see, we told you so. But there is going to come a time, and in particular right now, where people are looking to them for answers and solutions, because if they don't have answers and solutions, the result is going to be disastrous, like you were saying in the intro. I mean, this is a disaster. People's lives are on the line, and when that happens, when people are hungry, when they don't have food, when they don't have, you know, the basic resources they need to survive, they get desperate, and that is where government is supposed to play a role. And unfortunately, you know, they're just asleep at the wheel.
Yeah. So let me ask you last line of questioning then, because look, these 1,000-year storms and 500-year storms and 100-year storms, they seem to be coming much quicker.
Yeah.
Maybe my calendar's off. I don't know. But we seem to be having these historic storms for one reason or another. And you can you can surmise whatever you want. Is it climate change? Is it the angry God who's just ticked off because who knows what today? But the reality is I don't think they're going away.
Yeah, they're not.
So what do we do, you know, to start planning for, you know, setting up a system of, you know, maybe thinking, you know, down the road, how do we evacuate people from large metropolitan cities like Miami or Houston? How do we make sure that people get shelter and food to be able to weather the storm and then to be able to rebuild? At least, you know, it's kind of my thought.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I agree with you. And what I will say is that ultimately, you know, humans are resilient and we do have the capacity to evolve and to adapt. And again, you know, being someone who's lived in an area that is prone to storms, tropical storms, hurricanes, et cetera, I've seen my community make adjustments. I've seen the city of Houston make adjustments to withstand whatever comes in the future. Just to give you an example, when Tropical Storm Allison hit Houston, I believe that was 2002, I could be wrong about that, but basically the entire Texas Medical Center that's here in Houston took on water. The research community lost decades and decades of scientific research. So many animals, research animals, died and perished in that flooding. And so in response to that, the city obviously, you know, collected more tax revenue and put, you know, and recognize, hey, this medical center is one of the best things we have. It's great for the Houston economy, and it's great for the world, what we're doing here for medicine. And they made the investment. And so in this storm, in Harvey in particular, the way the Texas Medical Center withstood the flooding is amazing. I mean, no animals were lost. No research was lost. They have a whole underground storm system where they shut it down when it floods so water doesn't get down there. And that happened, you know, in a span of, you know, less than 20 years. So there certainly are things that we can do, but we have to have, you know, people who want to do it, who understand that there's a problem that is afoot, and that we have to be better prepared for it, you know, in terms of, you know, evacuation. You know, wouldn't a high-speed rail be nice? If instead of putting all these people on the highways in all these individual vehicles, if we could get them on a high-speed rail and get them, you know, evacuated away from the storm, how fast could we do that?
Yep.
If we told, you know, if we had a policy where employers could let people off of work soon enough to evacuate safely, you know, because that's one thing that gets lost in this. People always say, well, why didn't you leave earlier? Well, some people, their jobs won't let them leave. They're not going
to
get paid.
Yep.
And so what can we do in terms of how we treat people and from a policy standpoint, so they can make safer decisions for themselves? But again, I think all of it still boils down to, understanding that there is a role of government, in this situation, and understanding that we can, make investments in our infrastructure, and we can reduce our dependence on fossil fuels so that we're not contributing. But again, I just think people have to have some basic acceptance of the phenomenon of man-made climate change.
I'm with you. And at the end of the day, out of these tragedies, there's the chance for opportunity to make sure that the future, well, we don't do these. I mean, I look at countries like the Netherlands, who are almost completely underwater, and yet, you know, they've figured out how to deal with it. You know, Jane, I wish you the best. I'm glad you're safe and well, and your family's well. But I wish you the best going forward.
Thank you. Thank you. And to everybody listening out there, I really appreciate all of the love and support and prayers that came my way, because that definitely helped us get through it. So I appreciate it.
Good stuff. Jane, thanks so much. Look forward to talking to you again next week.
You too. Have a great week.
Good stuff. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people.
We're on the road to nowhere.
Thought back to America. Rick Smith.